Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the iHeart Guitar Podcast. Man, I've been crazy busy these last few weeks. I've had some magazine deadlines, we renovated my son's bedroom to be all really cool and steampunk, and I'm sure you'll see some pics of that on my Instagram. We did this really fun thing where I made a kind of steampunky looking box for his clock radio. So I put like a guitar preamp tube in it, and I put all these LEDs in there, and it was a lot of fun. But it gave me some ideas for like rehousing some of my guitar pedals that I'll probably never get around to doing, but it was fun to think about. But this week's episode is an interview with Michael Ciravolo, who you may know as the president of Schecter Guitars. Michael also has a band called Beauty and Chaos, and he and I have a lot in common in terms of like the kind of music we like, the kind of guitars we like, just the bands we're into, and a lot of stuff. So I first met Michael in person a few NAMMs ago, and when I was thinking of great guests for this podcast, I thought that guy and I have a lot to talk about. So I hope you enjoy this. It's a really fun chat, and what I really dig about it is we all know Schecter for all the great metal guitars they do and stuff, and Michael certainly doesn't shy away from that, but he also has a real appreciation for the kind of like semi-hollow bodies and Bigsby's and all that cool stuff. So we talk a bit about that and how that's expressed itself through Schecter's current lineup. And we also talk about The Cure and a bunch of other stuff, but lots about his new forthcoming album as well. So check it out. I hope you enjoy this, and I will catch you guys soon. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, like the things on all the social things, and share the stuff and all that stuff. It all helps. I'll catch you guys soon. Michael, I first met you a couple of NAMMs ago, but I've always been up there stalking the Schecter guitar booth and kind of checking stuff out. And I think the first thing that really stood out to me on my first visit to the NAMM show was, my God, whoever's behind this company has a lot of the same musical tastes as me. Can you kind of backtrack and kind of tell us about your music and what you're into?
Well, I think you were one of the first guys that thankfully came in and kind of got that we weren't just a metal guitar company. Mm. You know, we definitely have those bands and they're friends of mine, and they obviously sell a lot of product for us, a lot of guitars and everything, and it's kind of, you know, good or bad, become what we've known for, but we've always had this kind of retro-inspired, you know, at least for me, that I've always snuck that in, and it kind of flies under the radar, kind of not always by choice, but having, you know, fantastic bands like The Cure and The Mission, and even stuff like Cheap Trick and things like that, that, you know, weren't Avenged Sevenfold, Papa Roach, or, you know, even heavier stuff like a Bop and Gwar, it kind of gives us like a really cool balance, and it sure keeps the job interesting for me, doing those kind of things that I love, you know, basic style guitars, Bigsby's, mini humbuckers, all the, you know, kind of doing stuff that I would play and do play. It's kind of becomes like a dream job at times.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's, as you say that, I'm sitting here with my little Squire Basics. I mean, it's not little, these things are huge. But, you know, I love seeing that you've kind of led the charge in bringing that instrument back. Like, it's so unique. It's so, like, for me, a lot of my musical ideas happen to live in that lower range, and I didn't realize it until I got, you know, this instrument. How much do you play it?
You know, I love doing like the kind of droney stuff with it, and you know, I mean, I love the Pornography album, and you know, to me, it's like that's the way The Cure uses that instrument is kind of my, you know, reason for doing it, but. You know, also as a teenager, I loved like Aerosmith Rocks, and like a Back in the Saddle riff was played on like a Fender Basic style guitar. So, I mean, it's got a lot of uses. You know, the way I see it used isn't like, especially if you're looking at the NAMM show and people walk by and they pick it up, they immediately try to play a bar chord on it. And, you know, it's a different type of instrument, you know. And like I say, I always refer to pornography and Faith and those classic early Cure albums that, you know, really feature that instrument. And, you know, in the right hands, it's definitely a creative tool, you know, and I've seen people online, you know, do it, use it for different ways. But, you know, for me, it's definitely through a pedal board and, you know, open strings and high up the neck and stuff like that. But it, like I said, it's a very creative tool and, you know, you can write a lot of stuff with it.
Yeah. And now you also mentioned that you guys do a lot of guitars with Bigsby's. I'm a huge Bigsby nerd to the extent that my son's middle name is Bigsby. So there you
fantastic.
Go.
yeah, I like most of the guitars that I use on stage and in the studio have it. I mean, I think back in the late 80s, I had my short Floyd Rose period, but never so much like the Eddie Van Halen, you know, dive bomby thing and all. You know, just something about the Bigsby is very expressive. And yeah, we probably do more guitars than we should with Bigsby's on them, but I think it's a great tremolo. If people give them a chance, I mean, it's not like a, you know, it doesn't have to be a surf guitar. You know, I play pretty gamey a lot and can do some interesting stuff. Plus, you can still get through a song if you break a string. Which is also a cool feature.
Yeah. I see you a lot with a, I guess it's a TSH-1B. Is that correct?
Yeah, that and a Corsair tend to be my two go-to instruments. You know, the TSH I definitely got into because of the little mini, sort of mini humbuckers that we had wound for that just seemed to work great in front of pedal boards. You know, they don't tend to drive the front end so much. And I don't know, it's just a cool, like the size and everything. It just seems very natural for me, even though I do love the Corsair. And I've, like the last, you know, I've been doing some live shows as of late with Gene Loves Jezebel and Michael Aston. And that's kind of my go-to guitar in that band. It does, you know, the humbucker and the bridge of my Corsairs kind of work in that context, but both of those guitars to me are fantastic. You know, you can control feedback real well with them and have that whole Jesus and Mary Chain thing going on, and just a cool trem. I've added these little, and I'm sitting here staring at them across the my office here, and there's this little device that a non-Bigsby company made that you put on it that makes changing the strings a lot easier. If I can't think about it, I will send you a link or a picture. Since you're a Bigsby dude, I think you will love this if you don't already know what it is. Uh-huh. It definitely makes it where you don't have to bend the strings and try to get them on those little posts and end up sticking the high E string in your finger and bleeding for hours and stuff.
One time I accidentally strung my a couple of strings of my Bigsby upside down because I wasn't paying attention. And so then when you start to, you know, push the bar down, some of the strings go up in pitch and some go down. And it's like, oh, that's great. If only there was a musical use for this.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm actually going across the office. I'm trying to see if I have one, the device here, but I'll find it and send it to you. But, you know, thankfully for me, like have, you know, with my job at Schecter, I'll, you know, before a show, I'll bring the guitars I'm going to use downstairs and have Todd or one of the guys in my setup department string it. So I'm a little bit spoiled with having to change my own strings, you know, but this device certainly makes it nice. And if I ever broke something on a show, I think I could probably change it in a minute as opposed to sitting down with it for 30 minutes to attempt to get it strung.
Yeah. It must be really fun to be able to, fun and informative to be able to take things out to a show and kind of test them, see what works, what doesn't, you know, that kind of ability to be a player you know, and also be working behind behind the scenes must, you know, really give you a lot of insight into how things work.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've gone back and forth over the, you know, I've been doing Schecter now for a little over 20 years. And, you know, everybody always thinks, ah, it's a dream job. You must just play guitars. And, yeah, there's guitars all over my office and everything. And I'm not going to say the job sucks, but it does become a job. And I have had, like, sort of a love-hate thing with the guitar. Kind of when something that you love so much becomes the source of your income, you know, I've struggled sometimes not just getting inundated and it becoming a means, you know, to put, you know, food on the table or pay rent, you know, it becomes like you're selling something. And I've definitely been guilty of losing sight a little bit sometimes, but I am certainly now with doing this record and playing live and everything back on the upswing of, you know, my love for the instrument and, you know, trying to keep grounded why I picked this up in the first place and why as a kid I used to love to tinker and change pickups and kind of, you know, loved weird guitars. Like, you know, I had a thing for Ovation, Deacon, and Breadwinners. And I've always loved, you know, electric 12 strings and, you know, I always loved double cutaways. Like as a kid, I loved the Hamer double cutaway guitars because I could never afford like, you know, Johnny Thunder's Les Paul Special or anything. But, you know, right now I'm in a really good place with the instrument, you know, and Schecter's doing well, you know, in an industry that might be on the downswing, but it's kind of nice to see guitar music kind of resurfacing again, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your music because you've just before this interview, you sent me a full track and there's also a snippet of Finding Beauty in Chaos on the website. So talk us through what you're up to.
Well, I've always, you know, being a guitar player, and I've done stuff where I've sung and everything, but I've always, you know, been a guitar player in a band, moved out here in a band called Human Drama, which I've played in and done records and been out of and back in over the years. And I've also played with Gene Loves Jezebel, which was a band that had a couple of decent-sized MTV K-Rock hits in the mid to late 80s, and I've done live stuff like with them and done records. But I kind of wanted to do something that I was, you know, totally in control of. And I had just worked on Johnny's, the newest Human Drama record. And I guess to say it was a frustrating experience only because the sound of the band that it's morphed into, you know, there's keyboard, there's real strings, there's an acoustic guitar, and it's dense and sparse, you know, in a weird way. And as I was really, you know, into creating sounds and textures and, you know, a pedal junkie, I guess you would say, and really wanted to create all these textures and seeing them not get used in the mix or just muted because, you know, there's only so much space, kind of was really the genesis and spark that went, you know, where I just kind of went, fuck it, I'm going to do my own record. And kind of, I think you said you interviewed Mark Thwaite. I know Mark did a record called Volumes where he, much like me, is a guitar player and has played with some, you know, pretty named people. But, you know, to do a record on your own, I mean, no one really buys a Ron Wood record to hear him sing, or even like Mick Ronson or guys that were my heroes. It's not like you really care necessarily to hear him sing. So looking at what Mark did, I kind of, you know, basically nicked his idea and went, well, maybe I can get some singers that would want to do it, you know.
Well,
and,
I mean, you nicked his singer too because you've got Ashton Knight on this.
Yeah, that was a fantastic introduction, and that Mark had, well, at that point, Ashton wasn't his singer. He did a couple of songs on the record, but it was a fantastic introduction by Mark for me to meet Ashton. And I don't think in my years of doing this really had songs come together as quick as I've had with Ashton. You know, it's, we kind of are really on the same page, and, worked really well, which is why he actually does three songs on this record. It was so easy to work with him. But to jump back, I mean, when I was like, okay, let me see if I can do it. And I sat down with my engineer producer, Michael Rozon, who just made, you know, I've worked with in the past in a project called Drain the Doves. And I mean, he's just a fantastic engineer producer. And he really made this where I could sit and play and not sit behind the board and do the Pro Tools editing stuff, which I just used to love and now really despise. Because you get so wrapped in that side of it that it was like, not really do it playing or working on a song. So he really took that part over. And when we talked about can this happen, I mean, the first two singers that we had come in and do tracks were Robin Zander and Al Jorgensen. So going Cheap Trick Industry, I mean, both of those guys are friends, but when they come in the studio, it did get a little surreal sitting on my couch with Robin Zander and him asking me what I think. And then I thought part of me was just like this kid having Budokan or In Color on my turntable, you know, and that, you know, not to ever, you know, I'm in a position to be fanboy, but, you know, I mean, fuck, those were, you know, Cheap Trick was a big part of my youth. And, you know, I mean, in the 90s when I got into industrial and stuff like Nine Inch Nails and Ministry were two big bands that, you know, that I really liked when I was really kind of doing some aggro stuff. And having them both, the people right out the gate working with me, made me know that, yeah, this record could happen. And then the very next song was with Ashton. And I, you know, Mark made the introduction. We talked, you know, probably 30 minutes on the phone on the weekend. I pressed send and sent him just a mix of a music mix of a song. And Tuesday, he sent back, and it's a song that's going to be on the record called Storm, and it's absolutely fantastic. And I think that was the moment that I went, okay, this can actually really happen. And, yeah, it was very cool, and I'm loving every minute of doing this record.
Yeah. Well, I see also the song you sent me, Man of Faith, mixed by Tim Palmer, who, of course, you know, he did Tin Machine, right?
He did Tin Machine. He did, I mean, in the late 80s when I moved out here, I mean, I loved, like, The Mission, God's Own Medicine, and Carved in Sand. I mean, those, I, you know, when asked, those are probably two records that would be on my Desert Island 10. And I always thought Tim was just amazing. I spent hours, you know, as, you know, when I kind of had the producer bug back during that time, listening to some those records in the headphones and kind of picking up his, or trying to pick up his tricks. But yeah, he did the Tin Machine record. He's mixed, I think, stuff for YouTube. I mean, his resume is pretty crazy when you look at the band. He's mixed stuff, The Cure, and he's brilliant. To me, he is like part of that Mission sound that was so, that I thought was so great. He knew how to mix those electric 12s and Wayne's voice with the effects, but it never got, you know, buried. So, having that, Mark made another introduction for me. So another hats off to Mark Way here, but he introduced me to Wayne, and we started talking guitars over, you know, email and stuff, and started with the idea of working on doing a Wayne Hussey 12 string, and, you know, he was using it on some of the Mission tours, and he invited us to a Mission show a few years ago here in Los Angeles. My wife and I went and met, and I hit it off real well with Wayne, and actually when we was doing the last record that Tim was mixing, he invited me down to hear them work on the mixes, Another Fall from Grace, and you know, that's why I broached the idea going, hey, I'm doing this record, you know, would you listen to two songs and see if you'd be, you know, want to do it? And, you know, he said, sure, send them to me. And about a week later, he emailed me back and said, I love them both. I mean, I was hoping to get one song from him. And when he hit me back and said, I love them both, it was like, great. You know, I mean, I think some people are going to go, you know, yeah, you got guys that you do guitars for, are going to be on your record. And That isn't the case. I don't think anybody that's on this record would do it if they didn't really like the song, because it wasn't me sending them, here's some words, here's, you know, this is my demo of me singing. It was really, hey, co-write this with me. And they you know, Wayne, Ashton, Robin Zander spent a ton of time on the track, sending me like little iPhone things back that he was playing the song on his computer on the road, but recording it on his iPhone and singing and going, hey, what do you think if we move this part here? And he went to like, you know, a program they had on the computer and did like a real remedial edit of it. But I got the idea. But my point is that they really put the time in, and you know, I'm really blessed that everybody, you know, that was involved did this, because they certainly didn't have to. And I'm just, you know, thrilled that they did it and that they actually, you know, were really into it. So I think it's got the makings of a fantastic record.
Yeah. Well, you've got one of my favorite bass players on there, Simon Gallup.
Yeah, Simon is, you know, I have to say, other than my wife, Simon is my favorite bass player. And I think Wayne says the same thing. He says, other than Craig, it's his favorite bass player. But, I mean, Simon's just, he's probably the, you know, the most signature bass player, you know, that I listen to. And such a nice guy. And, you know, I've had quite a few nights, you know, with The Cure and drinking and Simon and I talking music. And the last tour he had his son, Eden, out on the road teching for him, and Eden's got a band called Violet Vendetta that's actually really cool. And when I asked Simon about doing it, he said, sure, send it. And you know, when he wrote me back, he said, I have a bass line that's kind of like Love Song, and it's like, what do you think? And it's again one of those moments like, oh, what do I think? So that was actually cool. And you know, they tracked Simon tracked it at his kid's house, you know, drove 2 hours to his son's house in their little studio and tracked it. And, you know, kind of cool. The first time that Wayne and Simon have been on a song together. And I mean, they're both from, you know, two pretty prominent bands, if you want to label it goth, are in that dark wave thing, The Cure and The Mission. And they've known each other, and putting them back in touch and them being on that together, it's kind of rekindled. They told me that years ago they had talked about doing something together, and Wayne, after doing this, went and dug up a cassette that had some Simon bass lines. So there is some talk that as soon as whatever The Cure are going to do this year is done, doing something with Wayne, Simon, and actually Budgie from Susie and the Banshees. Which, wow. I think would be a pretty fantastic trio. I've offered my guitar services, but I think Wayne would probably play guitar in it.
Yeah.
But it was kind of cool actually kind of putting that together. And again, you know, I don't like to throw, you know, two guys that I idolize, but certainly two guys that I really respect and listen to their music actually playing, you know, a song or co-writing a song with me and being on the song together is pretty cool. Not gonna lie.
Back in 2016, The Cure toured Australia, and Reeves invited me to go hang out with the guys after the show. And Robert wasn't there, but everyone else was, and we were just kicking back, you know, hazelnut martinis all night and stuff. But something really stood out to me, which is that even though Robert wasn't there, the other guys were talking really fondly of him and, you know, just his creative genius and stuff. Whereas I've been with some bands where they kind of shit on the guy who's not there. And, you know, to me, it's like, well, that guy's a genius, and obviously everyone knows it. So I was wondering what it's like to work with him on a guitar. Like, how does his mind work when it comes to that stuff?
You know, he has a pretty set idea of what he likes. I think we started working on the first guitar with him in 2004 or 5. I mean, I had a feeling we would talk Cure, so I was trying to rack my brain. How did that work? And I think the way that turned out was Paul Raven from Killing Joke and Ministry was doing our stuff. He brought Reeves in, who knew the Cure because of just doing Sorry Wrong Number back then. He's like, oh, sure, I'll let me introduce. And then, you know, when he went home, there was the email going, Michael, meet Robert. Robert, meet Michael. And, you know, we just started talking guitars. And I think I sent him like a TSH that he played a bit. And I think he had one of our Roundback acoustics. So it really goes back. But then when we started talking about the guitar, I think he gravitated towards the Ultra body style, which to me was odd. But then you look back at some of the guitars that Robert played, the Jazzmaster, the Gretsch, the National and stuff. I guess it wasn't that far of a stretch. And he kind of just did like drawings, you know, and sent me pictures. It was very remedial how we did it. You know, it was, I think there was faxes. There was, you know, drawings that he kind of went in with some draw program and just drew a red line a little wider here, a little more here. And it was kind of organic and weird how we were doing it, but it worked out. That as far as electronics and stuff, he's like, oh, whatever you think. You know, I still have me pedals that I've had forever. So I think at that point we just put Duncan 59s in it, figuring he'd wanted something that was clean and which is the guitar he played for quite a while. Then this last tour, I think he just wanted it shaped a little bit different and thinned down some, which again, we kind of worked in a program over the computer. I mean, I've met with him a few times, but usually drinking and not so much on guitars. The one time at the Barnes studio, in Barnes Olympic Studios, we did talk guitars. But yeah, he's open, but he's also knows what he wants. And as far as those guys, everybody in the band, you know, I mean, Robert, I would say is the Cure, because I don't think that, to me, Cure without Simon Gallup in it. But, you know, I think as long as Robert wants to do it, you know, I think there'll be a Cure. And, you know, I thought that song they played, It Never Could Be the Same, was fantastic.
Yeah.
The last go-round.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough, they invited me down for the start of the U.S. tour they were doing in New Orleans, which is my hometown. And that was the first show of the tour, actually at the college I went to. And they were going to rehearse there for 2 days before the tour. So I kind of got to go down there and hang, while they were rehearsing. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Robert had a set list of 120 songs that everybody needed to learn, because they would change the set list pretty much every night. They had three pretty distinct set lists that they played, but that's a lot of homework.
That tour was amazing because, like, they played everything that the people who only know the radio songs would possibly want to hear, and then they played like B-sides and rare stuff that the hardcores wanted to hear. They went for three frigging hours, and
yeah,
it was like
pretty crazy.
Everything
I think
you can want.
They did the song off The Crow, which I don't think they've played live before. You know, I got to see them rehearsing that. I think they even played The Blood, which doesn't happen a lot. And then the two new songs, which I thought were fantastic. So I hope there is a dark record in there. I remember Roger telling me, there were some tracks that didn't get released on the Ross Robinson record. And there's some stuff floating around there, but I don't know. Sometimes I think Robert has a little bit of a warped idea of what everybody in the States wants to hear from The Cure. I think because of the success of them on MTV and stuff, I think he thinks people here in the United States, at least, do like the poppy Let's Go to Bed and, you know, Friday I'm in Love and stuff like that. Whereas I think the fans that have really stuck with the band do want to hear, another dark record, which I thought they touched on with Blood Flowers. I thought, not that I have any input in it, but when I get to bend his ear, that's usually what I'm telling him. So I'll tell him what'll happen.
Yeah, cool. So what's your kind of, you know, guitar origin story? What got you started to, you know, starting to play in the first place?
You know, when I was a kid, I probably watching TV and seeing bands like David Bowie, Kiss, New York Dolls, and kind of that glam rock thing. You know, I Rock Scene magazine and, you know, picking up that kind of stuff and always a bit of that, you know, kind of ragged guitar play. I mean, Johnny Thunders is a huge influence for me as a kid. I love Mick Ronson. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff I could, as when I bought my first guitar, I could play. I didn't really, you know, in high school, like the stoner kids were all into Zeppelin and Moody Blues and stuff like that. And I just couldn't stand that, you know, partially because I couldn't play it. You know, I mean, Jimmy Page later I realized was, you know, not only a brilliant guitarist, but, you know, the way producer and songwriter, the way he crafted it. But as a 15-year-old kid, I just didn't get it. And I could play stuff like the New York Dolls and Kiss and, you know, David Bowie stuff. And, you know, I kind of really migrated to that stuff in my formative years, which probably was partially guilty and stunting my growth that I've never gone past that. But that's kind of was, you know, what sparked me, you know, kind of the high heels and, you know, wearing some makeup and having, you know, just kind of a bit of showmanship, you know, on equal or maybe even more important than actually the technical ability. And, you know, it got me started. And then, you know, later I got into, you know, stuff like The Cure and Sisters of Mercy and Lords of the New Church. And I love the psychedelic Furs and kind of that stuff, I think, is where I really started kind of playing guitar a little bit different and writing songs.
Yeah. But also that stuff to me, like, the whole, especially once the whole kind of, you know, gothic thing starts to come in, you feel like you're a part of a world by stepping into it and kind of adopting some of it. Like, you know, when I found my goth crew at a college, you know, it was like, ah, these are my people, you know, and, you know, it feels like there's a community there. And to me, music's always best when it's part of a community.
Well, the people I have found are very loyal. You know, doing my time that I've done with Human Drama, even though I don't think the band is a goth band anymore, especially it's gotten a bit lighter and stuff through the years. But we somehow, especially in Mexico and South America, really adopted that band. And, you know, they are loyal. And I find that most people do that like dark wave style music do like lyrics. And they do, you know, for the most part, when someone wants to come up and talk, it's not necessarily about a guitar part or a sound or anything that's like that. It's like, what do you mean when this was said and stuff like that? So I think, you know, most of those bands are very lyrical and, you know, open to interpretation. It's kind of cool to hear, you know, what people, how they envision the songs. And, you know, a lot of times, like, oh, me and my wife got married to this song and we did, you know, this, I strummed this on acoustic at my mom's funeral, and, you know, stuff that's like pretty heavy. And I think that comes with, you know, I mean, people will just say, oh gosh, you know, they wear lipstick and makeup and, you know, that. And it's, to me, it's very different culture. And I think they appreciate music, differently than someone that's just looking for singles or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that should probably do it, because I've got a whole bunch of articles to write now. you know, the life of a freelance journalist, I never get to stop. But I've really enjoyed this. Is there anything you want to kind of, you know, any websites and things you want to point people to before we go?
You know, we just did the website, which is going as the record right now is in almost the mix stage. There is one more song that my wife is actually going to sing that I put back on the My Bloody Valentine Loveless record. And for a period, I just loved that shoegaze, like, wall of sound and kind of that Wash, where lyrically you weren't, it was almost the voice was, you know, like was part of the instrumentation. So I kind of thought that would be a nice inclusion in this, and she does that real well. And that's the last song we have to finish, and then we're going to buckle down to mixing. And we just launched the website, which is beautyinchaosmusic.com. I think a photographer just had Beauty in Chaos. But, you know, since I am going hopefully to have this stuff placed in film and TV, which, because I think the stuff has a very soundscape vibe to it, that'll be the webpage that, you know, kind of putting up lyrics, pieces of mixes as I actually try to figure out what the step is, whether I go with a small label, whether we put this out ourselves. I mean, very different now trying to figure out what you do with music. You know, I know I do want this to be vinyl, you know, but beyond that, I don't know. I don't know. Actually, I try to look how my kids buy music, and it's download or it's Apple Music, and I think they're missing so much. So that site will very much keep up with what we're doing and where our head's at and progress and then what's going to happen with it.
Hmm. Cool. Well, thanks so much for your time. It's been great to chat.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Anything I can do or any questions, please don't hesitate.
Of course. Well, thanks. Have a good night.
You too, my friend. Take care.
Cheers. See ya.